science story.
Is NYU scientist the...
I felt right.
I figured it out.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Story Collider, where we bring you true personal stories about science. We are your hosts, Aaron Barker.
And Liz Neely. And this week, we are presenting stories about questions that just need answers. That's right. We're talking about hypotheses.
Ooh.
I know. You can just like hear me smile when I say the word. I get so excited. I feel like hypotheses are the building blocks of the scientific method. It's like the first thing we learn, right? Like, why is an egg shaped like an egg?
Some of these are questions that never occurred to many of us to wonder about.
Right. Okay. So I read a paper that I'm really excited about. And this is not about chicken eggs, but rather insects, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you take an observation about the world, like big bugs tend to lay big eggs, small bugs lay small eggs, right?
Makes sense.
And then you might extrapolate from there to a hypothesis, something like egg size is constrained by the body size of a female. Before we go any further, though, Erin.
Okay.
Are you ready to guess what is the biggest insect egg in the world?
Oh, my God. I feel like I'm afraid to know the answer. Is there any way I can guess and then you could not tell me?
Just like wipe that information from your mind. Well, I'll tell you what it's from. It's from a jungle nymph stick insect.
Of course.
Which is also the heaviest, second heaviest insect in the world.
The jungle nymph insect, legendary for its egg size. I would guess like an inch in diameter.
Ooh, about half that. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's a relief. That's surprising.
Yeah. Like it's a blueberry size. I was like, that's a friendly size or like a little
friendly size.
The head of a Lego figure.
It's fun size.
Right. But another important fact, not all insect eggs are egg shaped or round. Some of them are like banana shaped or other interesting things like that. And this paper that I read that I loved comes out of Dr. Cassandra Extevor's lab. It's in Nature. And what they did was they created a database of more than 10,000 descriptions of insect eggs. And guess what they found?
Again, I'm afraid to know. What did they find?
A whole lot of nothing.
What?
I've never seen scientists so excited that so many previous hypotheses proved to be wrong. So egg size not constrained by like the growth, development speed, or the mother's body size, but rather things like the ecology of where they like lay their eggs.
No. Oh. Wow. Yeah.
Scientists, sometimes they like proving each other wrong. Hey, it's me. Suddenly it all makes sense.
Yeah, a lot of pieces are starting to come together for me.
Well, our storytellers this week know a thing or two about hypotheses, I suspect.
Yes, I think we've got some hypotheses to be proven or disproven today.
That's right. Falsified.
Sure. You ready to get started?
I am. Our first story is from Sochi Garcia. It was recorded in September 2019 at the University of Rhode Island in Kingston. This was part of a show sponsored by the Inclusive SciComm Symposium.
Sixth grade. We're in a sixth grade classroom, 603. We're spending a week on the characteristics of life. You know, not a big deal. Living, non-living, no worries. And the basic premise is to start this week out, we give them a bunch of examples of things that might be living, non-living, once living, whatever. And they're supposed to work together, and it's more about the discussion. It's more about the discourse. It's more about pushing each other and creating a schema. And They're sitting at tables. They've already done these observations. They walked around the room. They messed with objects. They looked at videos. They collected. And they're sitting down and they're starting to talk. And we didn't really have to do any prompting. I have a co-teacher, so we're walking around the room. And they're asking each other questions. They're like, well, no, like, that thing got hot. Doesn't that mean that it's reacting to something? Doesn't that mean it's living? Doesn't it violate one of your rules that you made? This rule is wrong. And they're having this really good debate. And my co-teacher and I are like, ah, we killed this. Like, kids are super into science. Like, oh my gosh. And we're like high-fiving each other. And I'm walking around the room and we're observing conversations. And I pass by a table and I hear, fire's definitely alive. I'm like, okay, cool. This is why we do science in groups, right? This is why they're together at a table and we're going to have a bigger discussion later. They'll push each other's ideas. They'll challenge. It'll be great. They're doing great science discourse. Their skills are amazing. I'm so excited. So I leave that table. I just walk around and I forget about fire is alive. I think it's going to go away. And let's just be clear, fire not alive, right? So sixth grade, we say life is grim. That's what I think it's funny. My co-teacher thinks it's funny. Kids do not think this is a funny definition, right? So our basic premise is like they grow, they reproduce, they interact with their environment, they have a metabolism. Life's grim, right? It's great. But they're supposed to construct that knowledge. It's not for me to give them. It's the most effective way. And so we get to the whole class discussion and I have a little inkling. I have a thought. I was like, the fire is alive. It's going to be gone. It's good. And we start categorizing. And sure enough, this table, we put fire up. Everybody's like, not alive, not alive. I'm like, great, great. Like winning. and then this table's like, no. It's alive. And I'm like, this one student took a table of four and convinced them that it's alive. And I start to freak out a little in my mind. I'm like, I'm that person people talk about. I'm that teacher that people talk about. Daily News, New York City teacher, like, thinks fire is alive. What an idiot. Like, high school teachers being like, what did your teachers teach you? Like, where did you come off with this idea? And I'm like, oh my God, oh my God, what do I do? And they start questioning each other. And I'm like, great, great, this is going well. And kids are like, well, they don't reproduce. This kid's like, bro, sparks. Sparks. I'm like, oh my God. And they're like, sparks, they grow. And they start to talk about all the things I just named, growth, right? They're like, fires grow. You see wildfires, they spread. They talk about nutrition. They're like, they eat wood, they eat paper, they eat whatever. And my co-teacher and I are slowly freaking out, looking at each other across the room. And so I'm like, I can handle this. I've got this. Like, I go to the front of the room and I'm like, do you see fire having babies? And the room gets silent. My co-teacher goes, what the fuck? Like, Val's, what the fuck? And I'm like, at that moment, I had two realizations. One, we had an entire week on characteristics of life. We had planned inquiries. We had planned all these studies. They didn't need the schema today. Right? They were growing a body of knowledge. They needed it by Friday. The second thing I realized is I just introduced a worse misconception to the students, which was that there's one paradigm of reproduction. I just told them birth was the thing. And now I'm going to have to spend a long time trying to take that visual of me birthing out of their minds. This is all to say that, like, why did I freak out? Like, why was I freaking out? We were well planned. I was in my second year of teaching. I had gone to a series of PDs about how introducing misconceptions in science, like, you don't want to say the misconception to students because they will remember what you say. You want them to voice misconceptions. And it was all bad, but I was trying, I was trying to do the best I could. I was trying to really do it. And it took a bit of, it was a moment of being humiliated to learn something good, which was that like, I can't control everything that goes on in the classroom, and that's not the point of teaching science, right? The point is to make space and opportunities for them to grow and grow their skills, build their own schema for this amazing inquiry and maintaining wonder in the world. And that was the thing I learned through this experience. And the other thing I took away was like, that week kicked ass. At the end of it, they had an amazing discussion about artificial intelligence and robots, where they applied these things that they had learned about characteristics of life, but added these ideas of ethics and humanity that we had not given them to this analysis in order to bring some of their experience and some of what they value into the way we think about like what deserves our treatment of living. And I'm 7 months pregnant. I am not going to give birth to fire, hopefully. And not in front of students. Although residents are students, so learning is learning. So maybe I'll be like, come on in, great. And I'm thinking about, you know, this life I'm bringing to the world. And one of the things that I really love is I love science. And I like thinking about humanity and science and this idea that it's not just a series of processes. It's not these things on paper. It's about the minds and the people and their thoughts and construction. And that's the kind of world that I want to bring a life into, is one where it's about learning, it's about being curious, but it's about you in that experience building your knowledge.
That was Soshi Garcia. Soshi is the K-12 Education Program Manager at Science Friday. She's a former school teacher who taught middle and high school science in the Bronx for 7 years. And, fun fact, she has a very green thumb. As a Fund for Teachers Fellow, she traveled to Ecuador to interview cacao farmers, and as a National Geographic Grosvenor Teacher Fellow, she circumnavigated Iceland photographing different plants for classroom projects, which is amazing. At Science Friday, she works with other educators sifting through piles of random junk that she insists is treasure to figure out cool ways for educators to explore scientific phenomena with their learners. You can find her making a mess at her home, her office, and the city at large, all in the name of great science education. I love her story so much.
Well, you produced this one, right?
I know. I've never laughed so hard. Like, just from the first time we spoke, I knew this was a killer, killer story. And I should point out that this one was made possible by the funders and organizers of the Inclusive SciComm Symposium, which is a conference all about combining theory and practice in our efforts to prioritize inclusion, equity, and intersectionality in science communication. Near and dear to our hearts, obviously.
Yeah, for
special,
sure.
Yeah, special thanks to Dr. Sunshine Menezes for making that show happen.
Yeah, I know you and Gastor had a blast going out to that show.
We really did.
And I know that all of us back at Story Collider, after hearing that story, are now a little bit suspicious that fire might be alive.
No, this is a public service announcement. I can't believe, like, of all the people, I am invested in combating misinformation and effective science communication. I'm sorry, this is not true.
I think those kids made some good points, that's all I'm saying.
No, Erin, no.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Our next story today is from John Rennie. It was recorded in August 2019 at Caveat in New York City. The theme that night was divergence.
All right. Listen, you seem like nice people. So I want to be straight with you. I don't know what you've heard, but I have never eaten a tarantula. Not even one. But if you're looking for a good recipe, there's one this spider researcher told me about that he swears by. You can write this down if you want. So what you're going to do is you're going to start with a good average-sized tarantula, and you're going to begin by soaking it in brandy for 3 hours. Told you this was a good recipe. So then you take out the tarantula, and you're going to stick it under the broiler on each side for like 5 minutes. Now, you're not trying to cook the tarantula at this point. You're just trying to singe off the irritating hairs on its legs, which are highly irritating. And if you swallow them, you might go into anaphylactic shock. So then you also, after you've done that, then you carve, you out, it's a two little venomous fangs, and you put a skewer through the tarantula, and you, put it into like tempura batter, and then you just sort of lightly saute it. Presto! There you have it. Fried tarantula serves one. I'm told it tastes like soft-shelled crab. Bon appetit. As I say, I have never eaten one of these, but these kinds of recipes are the sorts of things you encounter when you wander into the world of entomophagy. That is to say, the world of eating insects. That is something, yeah. You were a little too nostalgic in the way you responded to that, sir. Yes, but I can get that because way, way back in May of 1992, I had my own encounter of this sort. I was a staff editor and writer on the magazine Scientific American. Thank you. You can find subscription cards on the table, I'm sure. That was also the 100th anniversary of the New York Entomological Society. And they decided going to throw themselves a big party, and they decided to make this really interesting. They would have it at the Venerable Explorers Club on the swanky Upper East Side of Manhattan, and to make it extra special, they would have a banquet where they would be serving insects as food. Let me just make a note that on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, they are not commonly eating insects as food, even at the Explorers Club, at least that they know of. But I mean, let's be honest. We are all eating insects. We are. We have all eaten insects, and not just because we have all been in convertibles or gone on picnics. But because, remember, the Food and Drug Administration prescribes the maximum amount of insect parts that you can have in your breakfast cereal. So trust me, we're all eating insects all the time. And the reality is that outside of places like the United States and Europe, where this is kind of a fluke, there are really most cultures around the world actually have real traditions of eating insects, because the fact is that there are millions and millions of people who depend on eating insects as a vital source of protein. And there are arguments that really all of us should be trying to subsist more on insect protein rather than... You two need to get together after the show. More of us should be doing this sort of thing. Now, these were the sorts of details that made this a great thing for me as a writer for Scientific American, why it was that I proposed to my bosses that I go to the Entomological Society banquet and participate in this and write about the experience, and why I thought it was a great idea for me to do this. What I did not tell my bosses at the time was that I also had a secret personal agenda. You see, I have always sincerely loved insects in the sense that I find them beautiful and I appreciate their importance to the ecosystem. I love insects. Behind glass. I don't like them flying around me. I don't like them crawling on me. I don't like squashing them because the buggy mess is disgusting. I don't care for this. It bothered me. But somehow I got it into my head that if I went to this entomological society banquet, and if I ate insects, it would give me a sort of mastery over this fear. And I would triumph over it. And so I set off that night. And when I got there to the Explorers Club, boy, the joint was jumping. Sorry, that was sincerely an unfortunate choice of words. But no, really, because you see, they had 80 entomologists who were signed up to attend this. They would be eating the food at this banquet along with me. But there were three times that many reporters there. The place was, you should forgive the expression, swarming with reporters. All of them looking to find somebody who was actually doing this, because there were so many reporters, they could mostly just find other reporters, not people who were actually going to eat the insects. I, however, was. Now, when I walked in, frankly, it really was looked a lot like a lot of sort of high society affairs. You had the string quartet playing chamber music in the corner, and it's the open bar, so the wine is flowing, which was good, because the two things that I was sure of about this evening were I was going to be drinking heavily, and later, I was going to floss. But really, in most respects, it was just like any other big, elegant party. You had these formally dressed waiters walking around with silver platters, and they're walking up and say, "Oh, sir, may I offer you the beetle bread bruschetta? Perhaps you would care for some of the mealworm baba ganoush. Waxworm fritters with your choice of plum sauce or mango sauce. Perhaps you'd like the chocolate cricket torte." All real dishes. But that's not where I started. No, the first thing I decided to eat that night was I walked right up to this big wicker basket that was filled with roasted crickets and mealworms and waxworms. Huge basket of these things. Just sort of like a gigantic oversized container of sort of bar snacks. And I walked right over to those and I grabbed a handful of them. And the human mind is an amazing thing. You know, when you looked at any individual one of these roasted crickets, it really was not recognizable for what it was. But when you reach into a big basket of them and pull them out, and all the other contents shift down to fill the space, the pattern recognition abilities of your brain are so great that you instantly see it as this huge skittering mass of insects. So for me, the experience was just kind of like, oh, ah! Now I know, by now you are wondering, so how did these taste? And honestly, they were quite good. These sort of roasted crickets and the like, you know, basically, crickets are basically the six-legged tofu of the entomophagy world. I mean, basically, they have no real flavor of their own. They just take on the flavors of however they're being cooked, which in this case would be oil and salt, therefore delicious. So, you know, if you ate these, really, you would not particularly know or object to it. And in fact, in almost any of these cases where the insects were ingredients in the food, it was unnoticeable and completely benign, and honestly, you would think it was fine. And a lot of these things, they tasted really quite good. Not everything was great. There was this big wickety grub. Any Australians in the group? No? That's a sort of big larva. Picture something sort of like a big, pale breakfast sausage with a chive for a head. That wasn't great. But I will tell you, there was something that I thought was absolutely delicious, which were the honeypot ants. These had been flown in specially from Arizona. And these are like these little ants. Their abdomens are swelled up like little golden peas because they're filled with this honey-like nectar that they would hold for the other members of the colony. And they had these sitting in like a terrarium, and you would go out and they would just, you know, take out one for you. It was like going to a restaurant and getting a lobster. It was like oh, that one in the corner. That was nice. You know, pop it on your tongue. Really, it was delicious. It was like candy. It was wonderful. And so I was really feeling great about the entire experience of how all of this was going, and I was on the road to mastery, and then they brought out the final dish of the evening. And this, my friends, was sort of the pièce d'insect résistance, because this was the giant sautéed Thai water bug. Essentially, a huge cockroach sitting on a plate. Looking like it was trying to run off of the plate. Which I was hoping it might do. Because this was sincerely the quintessence of all of the fears I had about these insects. This was a giant, repulsive, buggy bug. And I saw it there on this plate, and I picked it up, and it had a heft to it, which was really disturbing, because it was about 3 inches long. Did I mention it was a giant Thai water bug? I picked it up, and I looked at it, and I actually felt this tremendous sense of inner calm, because what I realized was I had been eating all of these other insects, and I had been doing really well with that. And I could look at this giant Thai water bug and think, I don't really want to eat this. I don't need to eat this. And I got ready to put it back on the plate. And in that very moment, I suddenly became aware of a gigantic halo of lights surrounding me. The lights from all of the cameras, from all 250 of the reporters gathered there that night, who had decided I was the one they had to capture on video eating the giant Thai water bug. I felt trapped. Not unlike a bug in amber. That's right, keep your irony, there we go. So, I did what I felt I had to. Which meant that I first would have to make the most gruesome choice of my life. Which end do I eat first? Because it's too big to put in my mouth all at once. Do I eat the front end with the antenna and all the legs and the little mouth parts? Or do I eat the back end, the big swollen abdomen full of some sort of buggy guts? It's a real Lady and the Tiger moment, isn't it? My friends, I decided I would eat the front end first. Your approval means everything to me. I closed my eyes, I opened my mouth, and I bit down. And folks, this is how you discover that the universe is full of surprises, full of unexpected turns every day. Because, in fact, most sincerely, that bug was the most ghastly thing I had ever eaten in my life. It was a horror show. I mean, the flavor is grotesque. It's like cleaning fluid with a sort of acrid burnt barbecue sauce thing going on. But the flavor was nothing compared to the texture, because now, with each bite, the front end of this thing is turning into this giant swirling mass of disarticulating exoskeleton. Wings are poking me in the cheeks. I've got teeth. I've got legs, actual legs stuck between my teeth now. All I can do is just like look out at all of these cameras and go, ha! Good bug! I had not succeeded in managing to master my fear of these things. Quite the opposite. By trying to power through this, I had only succeeded in literally feeding the nightmares I feel to this day. And in answer to the question that I know you have, no. The second bite was not any better. Thank you.
That was John Rennie. John has worked as a science editor, writer, and lecturer for more than 30 years. Currently, he is deputy editor at Quantum Magazine. During his time as editor-in-chief at Scientific American between 1994 and 2009, the magazine received two National Magazine Awards. He co-created and hosted the 2013 series Hacking the Planet on the Weather Channel. And since 2009, he has been on the faculty of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program in New York University's Graduate Journalism School. Now, John is actually a member of Story Collider's nonprofit board, and he told this story the day of our annual board meeting, our annual in-person board meeting. So he had been with us that entire day.
He just couldn't get enough.
It's a real feat of endurance for John. And it's a truly, I think it's safe to say, unforgettable story.
Yep, that one's going to be sticking with me for quite some time.
And if you, like us, find John's story unforgettable, find the stories on this podcast to be really near and dear to your heart, we are looking for new producers to join our team at the Story Collider right now. And we are looking in Los Angeles, Chicago, the Bay Area, and Denver. So if you're located in any of those four places and you're interested in being a part of what we do, you can check out our full job description at storycollider.org/jobs, or you can send me an email at stories@storycollider.org and let us know what you think makes a great science story and why you'd like to be a part of the team.
The Story Collider is grateful to all of our team, and especially to John Rennie for his service.
Definitely.
The Story Collider is also grateful for the support of Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science.
The Story Collider is led by me, Artistic Director Aaron Barker.
And me, Executive Director Liz Neely, with help from Deputy Director Nissa Greenberg, Operations Manager Lindsay Cooper, and the rest of our amazing team, which might include you. Go to storycollider.org/jobs.
That's right. The stories featured in today's podcast were from shows produced by Gastor Almonte, Liz Neely.
Hey.
Paula Croxon and Nissa Greenberg.
The podcast is edited by our podcast team, including Zoe Saunders, Jun Chen, and Gwen Hogan. The theme music is by Ghost.
Special thanks to Caveat and the University of Rhode Island for hosting these shows.
And to all the budding scientists out there, forming, formulating, and falsifying hypotheses.
Good luck with those hypotheses, everybody.
Tank 'em.
Thanks for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.